It was Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Jill Robbins has a story on India's first solar village. Faith Perlow presents a new everyday grammar report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Jill Robbins.
Kesabai Prajapati works with material from earth, called clay, to make containers like jugs and vases. Prajapati recently became much happier while making his products. Prajapati is 68 years old and from the village of Modera in western India's Gujarat state. He is happier because he has doubled the amount of clay goods he can make compared to a few months ago. He creates his products on a machine called a potter's wheel. In the past, he was producing less because he had to turn the wheel himself. He could not pay the cost of running an electric motor. The electric bill was up to $18.19 a month. Now, however, his machine moves on solar power. Earlier this month, Prajapati's village was declared India's first village to run completely on solar power all the time. The village has around 6,500 people living there who mostly work with clay, clothes, shoes, or on farms. Prajapati said, "Electricity has helped us to save time and produce more products." India is the world's third largest carbon dioxide releaser, but it aims to meet half of its energy demands from renewable sources such as solar and wind by 2030. That is an increase over its earlier goal of 40%. The government said it met that goal in December 2021. The project in Modera was financed by the federal and local governments for nearly $10 million. It involved setting up over 1,300 solar panels on the tops of private and government buildings that were connected to a power plant. The government buys surplus energy produced from the villagers if they do not use all of the amount that has been given to the household. Praveen Bai is 43 years old and works with clothes. With the extra money, he plans to buy a gas connection and stove. Many houses in the village cook food on wood-fired stoves, which create smoke. He said, "I had to teach the kids under the street lamp. Now they will be able to study inside the house." Modera is known for its ancient sun temple, which honors the sun god. And it is located in Prime Minister Narendra Modi's home state, Gujarat. Gujarat will be holding elections later this year. Modi said earlier this month, "For a self-reliant India of the 21st century, we have to increase such efforts related to our energy needs." Reena Ben is 36 years old and sews clothes part-time. The solar power has hugely helped her work. She said, "When we got access to solar power, I bought an electric motor worth 2,000 rupees, or $24, to attach to the sewing machine. Now I am able to sew one or two more clothes daily." I'm Jill Robbins.
Next, Faith Perlow. Carlo presents a new everyday grammar lesson. Fans of Taylor Swift should be especially excited to listen to this one.
Two popular singers, Taylor Swift and Lana Del Rey, came out with a song together called Snow on the Beach. The song is about two people falling in love with each other at the same time, which is uncommon, like snow falling on a beach. In this week's Everyday Grammar, we look closely at this song. While there are many grammatical structures in it, we will look at just two words, unbeknownst and till. Let's listen to parts of Snow on the Beach.
I saw flags of what could have been lights, but it might just have been you passing by unbeknownst to me. It's fine to fake it till you make it, till you do, till it's true.
The word unbeknownst is an adjective meaning not known or existing without knowledge of someone. Unbeknownst sounds very old. It has the suffix st, which was put on the ends of some words hundreds of years ago. However, unbeknownst is a newer version of the old adjective unbeknown. Today, it is more common to hear someone using the adjective unknown. But from time to time, you will hear unbeknownst, just like in the Taylor Swift song. So how do we use this adjective? We mostly use unbeknownst with the preposition to. Something or someone is unbeknownst to someone else. Here, once again, are the lyrics of Swift's Snow on the Beach.
I saw flags of what could have been lights, but it might just have been you passing by unbeknownst to me.
We have the structure.
You passing by unbeknownst to me.
Unbeknownst to me is an adjective phrase. Adjective phrases contain an adjective that describe a noun that is close to the phrase. In this part of the song, unbeknownst to me, as an adjective phrase, is actually describing the direct object, the noun of you. Let's look at some other examples of how we can use unbeknownst.
Her mom's wedding dress in the back of the closet was unbeknownst to her.
Here, the adjective phrase of unbeknownst is modifying the noun and subject of the sentence, wedding dress. We can also use unbeknownst in the beginning of a sentence.
Unbeknownst to many cat owners, dry cat food can make their cats very thirsty.
Here, cat owners do not know that dry food can make cats want water. Now, let's consider till. The word till is a shorter form of until. We use it in everyday speech, especially when telling time or using dates. We use until for somewhat formal writing. The word till often appears in spoken language and in writing, like in songs or poems. Until and till mean up to a certain point or event in time. They can be either a preposition or a conjunction, linking two clauses together. Let us look at how Taylor uses till in Snow on the Beach.
It's fine to fake it till you make it till you do, till it's true.
In all three lines of the song, Swift uses till as a conjunction, linking the first clause to the second.
And it's fine to fake it, plus till, plus you make it. First clause, plus conjunction, till, plus second clause.
Remember that a clause is a group of words that contains a subject and a predicate. Clauses do not always contain a complete thought, like a sentence does. We can take the three other lines and create two additional sentences.
And it's fine to fake it till you do. And it's fine to fake it till it's true.
In these sentences, till is still a conjunction, linking the first clause with the second clause to make a complete sentence. Let us look at some other examples of how till can be used as a preposition. We can use till just like until, with points or events in time. Here are some examples.
We have till Friday to get the report done.
What time is it?
It's 10 minutes till 6 p.m. or 5:50 p.m.
In the summer, it does not get dark till later in the evening. Today, we looked at two interesting words from the song Snow on the Beach by Taylor Swift and Lana Del Rey, unbeknownst and till. Both of these words are newer forms of much older words. Unbeknownst is an adjective and is often used with the preposition to. Till is the short form of the word until and can be used as either a preposition or a conjunction. Now it's your turn. Have you heard or tried to use these words before? Do you know any other words with similar meanings or usages? Let us know in the comments. I'm Faith Perlow.
I'm Andrew Smith.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Thank you for that entertaining lesson. Now, let's test our understanding of one of the words we just learned about, unbeknownst. Which sentence is correct? A. My sister's train arrived early, unbeknownst to me. Or B. My sister's train, unbeknownst, arrived early. If you said A, you are correct. You can re-listen to this and other episodes of Everyday Grammar by visiting our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Jackson took office in 1829. He was popular with many voters. They saw him as the symbol of the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his vice president, John C. Calhoun. As his presidency went on, another struggle began. This time, it was Jackson against the Bank of the United States. The first Bank of the United States had closed in 1811. But without a central bank, the country's finances had suffered during the War of 1812. So in 1816, Congress provided money to establish the Second Bank of the United States. The bank could provide loans, pay bills, collect taxes, and move money around the country. Congress gave the bank a charter to do business for 20 years. The government owned one-fifth of the bank. A small group of private citizens owned the rest. Lawmakers gave the bank enormous power. The Bank of the United States had $35 million in capital. Some of that money came from the government. Most came from investors. Historian Bray Hammond notes that at the time, the Bank of the United States was the richest corporation in the world. The Bank of the United States also printed the country's paper money, and it was the only bank permitted to have offices across the nation. By making it easy or difficult for businesses to borrow money, the bank's owners could control the economy in almost any part of the United States.
What this means is that you are granting, and Congress did grant, exclusive privileges to the Bank of the United States, which meant exclusive money-making opportunities to its stockholders.
Historian Daniel Feller explains that the Bank of the United States helped the government to do its business effectively and efficiently. But it also helped the people who owned stock in the bank. During Jackson's presidency, a man named Nicholas Biddle led the Bank of the United States. Biddle was an extremely intelligent man. He had completed his studies at the University of Pennsylvania when he was only 13 years old. When he was 18, he was sent to Paris as secretary to the American minister. During America's war with Britain in 1812, Biddle helped establish the Bank of the United States. He became its president when he was only 37 years old. Biddle clearly understood his power as president of the Bank of the United States. In his mind, the government had no right to interfere in any way with the bank's business. President Jackson did not agree, nor was he very friendly toward the bank. Not many people from Western states were. They did not trust the bank's paper money. They wanted to deal in gold and silver. Jackson criticized the bank in each of his yearly messages to Congress. He said the Bank of the United States was dangerous to the liberty of the people. He said the bank could build up or pull down political parties through loans to politicians. Jackson opposed giving the bank a new charter. He proposed that a new bank be formed as part of the Treasury Department. The president urged Congress to consider the future of the bank long before the bank's charter was to end in 1836. Then, if the charter was rejected, the bank could close its business slowly over several years. Changing the banking system slowly, Jackson said, would prevent serious economic problems for the country. But the bank's president wanted to renew the charter early. He made the request in January 1832, 9 months before the next presidential election. Jackson's opponent, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky, was sure that the issue of the bank could win him some votes. Clay argued his case on the floor of the Senate for 3 days. He strongly urged the Senate to renew the bank's charter. He said the country was in the middle of a revolution, not yet a bloody revolution, but things were happening that pointed to a total change of the pure Republican character of the government. Power was being centered in the hands of one man, he said. He meant President Jackson. Clay added that if Congress did not act, the government would fail. Clay then asked the Senate to condemn Jackson, saying he violated the Constitution and the nation's laws. The Senate approved the resolution. The chief opponent to the bank was Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. He objected to the renewal of the charter, he told the Senate, because the bank was too great and powerful and made the rich richer and the poor poorer. The Senate finally voted on the bank's new charter. The vote was 28 for renewal and 20 against. The House voted 3 weeks later. It also approved the charter, 107-85. The lawmakers sent the bill to the White House. President Jackson debated it with members of his cabinet. Some wanted to negotiate a compromise, but Jackson decided to veto the bill in the strongest possible language. On July 10, 1832, Jackson sent a message to Congress explaining his reasoning. Jackson said he did not believe the bank's charter was constitutional. Jackson also spoke of the way the bank moved money from west to east. He said the bank was owned by a small group of rich men, mostly in the east. Some of the owners, he said, were foreigners. Much of the bank's business was done in the west. The money paid by Westerners for loans went into the pockets of the Eastern bankers. Jackson said this was wrong. Then the president spoke of his firm belief in the rights of the common man. It is to be regretted, he said, that the rich and powerful bend the acts of the government to their own purposes. Jackson said that instead, the government should shower its favors, as heaven does its rain, on the high and low alike, on the rich and the poor equally. Jackson's veto of the bank bill may have cost him votes among the wealthy, but it earned him votes among the common people, like farmers and laborers. He easily won re-election in November of 1832. Martin Van Buren became his vice president. Historian Daniel Fellers says Jackson believed his victory meant that Americans supported his policies, including the bank veto.
He had a very popular personal image. It's possible he would have been reelected by the same margin or larger anyway. The one thing we can say looking forward is that when later on you had somebody carrying on Jackson's policies absolutely faithfully, without Jackson's personal charisma, he proved to be not nearly so popular.
In his second term, Jackson stopped putting federal money into the Bank of the United States. Instead, he put the money into state banks. The bank president, Nicholas Biddle, fought with all his power to keep the bank open. He demanded that borrowers immediately repay their loans. Businesses struggled without the bank's assistance. Workers lost their jobs. Biddle blamed President Jackson for the financial panic. Critics of Jackson's bank policy called him King Andrew I. But as time passed, business people began to see that the Bank of the United States was being much tighter in its money policy than was necessary. They began to feel that it was the bank's president, not Jackson, who was responsible for the serious economic situation in the country. Biddle took no responsibility for the financial crisis. He then made a very bad decision. Biddle asked the governor of Pennsylvania to make a speech supporting the bank. At the same time, Biddle refused to lend the state of Pennsylvania $300,000. The governor was furious. Instead of making a speech supporting the bank, he made one that sharply criticized it. 2 days later, the governor of New York proposed that the state sell $4 or $5 million of stock for loans to help state banks. The New York legislature approved selling even more. Strengthening state banks helped break the power of the Bank of the United States. Nicholas Biddle began to see that the battle was lost. He started making more loans to businesses. The economic panic slowly ended. Jackson's victory over the Bank of the United States was clear. Biddle started to lose the support of many members of Congress. In the House of Representatives, James Polk proposed 4 resolutions about the bank. One said the bank should not get a new charter in 1836. The second resolution said government money should not be deposited in the bank. The third said the government should continue to put its money in state banks. And the fourth proposed an investigation of the bank and the reasons for the economic panic in the country. All 4 of these anti-bank resolutions were approved. One of Biddle's aides described the feelings of bank officials. "This day," he said, "should be ripped from the history of the Republic." He said, "The President of the United States had seized the public treasury, and the representatives of the people had approved it." Jackson won what he himself considered a glorious triumph. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.